is brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
Hi, this is Don Showalter from USA Basketball, and you are listening to the Hoop Heads Podcast.
Hey, Hoop Heads. Wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market, and they truly accelerate skill development faster than ever. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoop Heads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Also, make sure to check out the new Dr. Dish Home Machine, which is perfect for these crazy times when gyms and schools are closed. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoop Heads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
For our players, they have an opportunity to do that, and I need to help them in any way I can change the trajectory of UMass basketball and do something here that hasn't been done in a very, very long time.
Matt McCall is the head men's basketball coach at the University of Massachusetts. Coach McCall recently completed his third season at UMass after previously being the head coach at UT Chattanooga for two seasons, where he led the Mocs to a 48-18 record and was named the Southern Conference Coach of the Year in 2015-2016. McCall spent 11 seasons over two stops with Billy Donovan in Florida. After five seasons as a manager and graduate assistant, he was named Director of Basketball Operations before returning to Gainesville as an assistant coach prior to the 2011-2012 season. In total, McCall was a part of four SEC titles, four SEC tournament titles, two NCAA Elite Eights, a Final Four, and two NCAA titles. Between stints in Gainesville, McCall was an assistant under Mike Jarvis at Florida Atlantic for three seasons. Matt became the 22nd head coach in UMass history when he took over the program on March 29, 2017. We just launched our Hoop Heads Pod webinar series with some of the top minds in the game across all levels, from grassroots to the NBA. If you're focused on improving your coaching and your team, we've got you covered. Visit hoopheadspod.com/webinars to get registered. Please subscribe to the Hoop Heads Pod on your favorite podcast app. When you do, the latest episodes will hit your phone as soon as they drop. Let a friend or coaching colleague know about the show and join the thousands of others who have become a part of Hoop Heads Nation. As our audience of coaches continues to expand, we'd really love to hear your feedback. Drop me an email at mike@hoopheadspod.com or leave us a rating and review on your favorite podcast app. Be prepared to take some notes as you listen to this episode of the Hoop Heads Podcast with Matt McCall, head coach at the University of Massachusetts. Hello and welcome to the Hoop Heads Podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here with my co-host Jason Sunkel, and we are pleased to welcome from the University of Massachusetts, head coach Matt McCall. Matt, welcome to the podcast.
Mike, I appreciate you guys having me on tonight, man. It's a pleasure to be here.
Absolutely. We are very excited to have you on, talk about all the great things that you've been able to do in the game, all the great experiences and people that you've been able to work with. Want to go back in time first and start out talking about when you were a kid. How did you get involved in the game of basketball? What made you fall in love with it when you were younger?
You know, I think like most kids, you know, growing up in a family of athletics, my father was a middle linebacker at the University of Florida. So, you know, you play everything. You know, you play football, you play baseball, you play soccer. I even got on the golf course at a young age. And basketball was the one sport that just I kept kind of gravitating towards. I kept gravitating towards it amongst playing, you know, all these other things. I used to go to Lon Kruger's camp back in the day when he was the head coach at the University of Florida, and just kept gravitating towards the game. And, you know, it wasn't really, I tell people all the time when they ask me, how did I get started in basketball? I said, well, you know, my mother was a musician and my dad was a linebacker. And unfortunately for me, I got the body of a musician and the face of a linebacker. So, you know, basketball was an easy choice for me to pick. And, you know, my father, I give him so much credit because even, you know, he was a captain in the 1967, you know, Florida team. He never pushed me to play football. He wanted me to play and enjoy the things that I liked. And I just kept gravitating towards it. And it was probably, you know, when I started getting into middle school, where it became the thing that I was going to focus on the most, each and every day. I'll never forget, I was on a YMCA team, and I had a coach named Leroy Sims, who's still a very, very dear friend today. And, you know, we had a practice on an outdoor court at a park for our first practice, you know, in sixth grade YMCA ball. And, you know, my father, because he knows athletics, he could see that Leroy knew what he was doing and the way he, you know, structured practice or how he was in the game, his knowledge of the game. And, you know, when that season was over, my dad approached Leroy about, you know, working with me kind of on a one-on-one basis. And Leroy just did it out of the kind of his heart, and it just grew from there. And we would be on outdoor parks, you know, in Ocala that we'd rotate, and we'd go to Tuscaloosa one day. We'd go to, you know, Scott Kerrigan Park the next day. We'd go out to War Memorial one day. We just keep rotating around town, and he'd throw me into these pickup games against, you know, grown men, and I'm in sixth and seventh grade, you know. And it just became, you know, the game that I really, really wanted to focus on. And I ended up selecting my high school. It was the school that was closer to my house, but their basketball program was up and coming. And, you know, I played football, and going into high school, the varsity football coach had coached four of my uncles back at Ocala High, which is now Forest High School. And he would come in the gym, and I'd be in the gym working on my game, you know, in the fall, in September, after school, before school. And he'd always just stop and say, "When are you going to come play for me like your uncles did?" And I just would just not pay it any mind, because I knew I wanted to focus on basketball. So that's kind of, you know, how the journey for the game got started. And it just, it took off from there, and loved it, and played 4 years at Bellevue High School, and, you know, was able to compete in three state tournaments, and, you know, had a lot of fun playing, had some great teammates and some great teams. And, you know, you go through that, you got these dreams, these aspirations to play in college, and, you know, you kind of get hit in the face a little bit, you know, with reality. And I was a decent player. I worked really, really hard, didn't have any real scholarship offers, anything like that. But I love to work. I love the game. I loved being in the gym. And I kind of went through my whole senior year trying to figure out what was going to be next for me, and how could I continue, you know, with the game, you know, being a part of my life. And, you know, that was kind of a crossroads for me on what I was going to do.
So when you think back to that time and you're going through the decision, I assume the decision is, do I go and play at a Division III and NAIA school, that type of environment, or do I go and do something else and start looking at what are my options beyond playing? Is that kind of where you were at that point?
Yeah, we were kind of touring the state. Me and my dad and my mom, we were going to, you know, Division II schools like Rollins College, and you know, we visited different places like that, you know, Flagler, and checked out campuses to see. We ended up going and taking a visit to Stetson University, and I was going to be kind of a preferred walk-on there and be a part of the team at Stetson, and was going to go there and actually enrolled in summer school and went through a summer session there. It was just didn't feel right. Just wasn't the right fit for me. And I just didn't, you know, it's a very, very small school in the middle of Florida. Actually, one of my mentors now, Donnie Jones, is the head coach there, ironically. But it was just, you know, that was what I was wanting to do, but I don't know if that was ever the right place for me. And I was kind of still trying to figure it out. We had kicked around the ideas of prep school, you know, and I didn't really know about prep school back then, like I know now.
Right.
But, you know, it was kind of the military academies, the Hargraves, the Fork Unions. Is that the route I want to go? And then, you know, something just kept pulling me and dragging me back to the University of Florida. You know, my father played there, obviously. I had two older sisters that one had just graduated from there. My other sister was a junior in college there. I had friends that were going to school there. And something just kind of kept pulling me back to Florida, pulling me to the University of Florida. And, you know, it was kind of one of those things. Okay, well, you know, let me go to Florida and I'll play intramural basketball. I'll have basketball still as a part of my life. I'll play intramurals. I'll join a fraternity, because that's what everybody does when you go to Florida. You're either an athlete or you're part of the Greek life. I'll do that. I'll be a normal student, and I'm going to have a great experience, at that point in time, I kind of wanted to do the journalism route. And I was thinking about, you know, getting a degree in journalism, and maybe I wanted to be a journalist and interview athletes or be on ESPN or do something like that. So I was still at 18 years old. I was confused. I didn't really know what I wanted to do. I took a break really from the game. And that's when it was then in that year, that freshman year of college at the University of Florida, I couldn't have been more miserable. And while everyone was going out, having a great time, college life, this, that, and the other, I was miserable. This is not what I want to do. This is not what I want to be doing. I want to be involved in basketball. I want to coach. It was then and there. I didn't know, you know, what route I wanted to go as far as where the coaching piece was going to take me. But that freshman year in college, where I was away from the game and I was just a normal student at the University of Florida, I was hit with that dose of reality of, man, you're not doing what you're supposed to be doing, and I'm not having any fun here in college, and I got to get back involved in the game. And that's where it started.
Had you ever had any experience coaching, like when you were in high school? Did you coach like a youth team or anything like that? Did you have any experience at all with coaching, or was it just something that you're like, man, it doesn't matter what I'm doing, I got to be back involved in the game?
I had never really had any experience coaching at all. I love to work. I love to be in the gym. You know, I would get up before school, and if I couldn't get in the gym, I'd be in the driveway shooting. You know, I'd stay after practice. I'd try to get extra work in there. You know, Christmas break, going to the gym. You know, I loved working. I loved it. I loved being in the gym. You know, that back then you had that one class that was like your period class, but it was your varsity basketball class. We'd be in the gym. I loved working. And even my freshman year, you know, at Florida, I would, you know, Florida's such a big campus that I would find, you know, different gyms throughout campus, and whether it was a part of the rec center or not, sometimes I'd get kicked out. I'd go in and still just work on my game, you know, and I wasn't ever going to play after that, but I would just work, and I loved it. And, you know, really the start of my sophomore year, and I tell people this story all the time, they kind of ask, how did I get started at Florida? How was I fortunate enough to work with Coach Donovan? And, you know, I sat outside Jeremy Foley's office, who was the athletic director at Florida. And this is the fall of my sophomore year in college. Now, my dad played with Coach Spurrier at Florida. So Spurrier was still the football coach at Florida. And through that relationship, I knew Jeremy Foley, and Jeremy Foley knew who my father was. And so I went to Jeremy's office. This is the very beginning of my sophomore year in college, and I sat there, and his secretary is just staring at me like crazy. Okay, like, this is the athletic director of the University of Florida. Like, I don't know when he's coming back. He's in meetings on campus all day, Matt. Like, I have no idea when this guy's coming back. So I sat there for like 2 hours, and finally Jeremy walks in, and I just kind of pop up, and I just said, Mr. Foley, can I get 2 seconds of your time? And because of how great of a human being Jeremy is, and still look at him as, you know, one of the best athletic directors to ever do it. You know, I went to him, I said, Jeremy, I just want to be a fly on the wall over there with Coach Donovan. I don't know what that looks like. But I would love to just be able to watch practice, help out, do anything I can. And Jeremy set up a meeting for me with Donnie Jones, who was an assistant coach at the time. And they ended up hiring me as a student manager. And it was on from there. That's really how I got started at Florida, and, you know, very fortunate that I was able to get my foot in the door through Jeremy Foley.
So how many guys at a program like Florida, how many guys were managers during that time when you were there? So that first year, what number manager were you in the rotation?
Oh man, I was the bottom of the totem pole. that first year, I'll never forget. They didn't have enough seats on the bench for the games. You know, and so here we are. It's like the first exhibition game of the season. And I think back then it was like you played like those EA sports teams that were right, like made up of like former college players. And I remember that first game, they brought me and the other manager they had just brought in at the same time. His name was Brian Reeves. And they said, hey, all right, we're going to flip a coin to see who gets to sit on the bench tonight. And the head manager at the time was a guy named Bob Pozadek, who's a very, very good friend to this day. And we flipped the coin. I lost. So I had to sit up in the video booth with the video guy at the top of the arena in my first game as a student manager in the O'Connell Center. I was just dreaming about that all my whole life, being able to sit on a bench in the O'Connell Center for a game with the Gators. And my first game was up at the top of the Raptors in the video booth. So I was definitely the low man on the totem pole that year.
Dream delayed.
Yeah, no question. No question. All right,
so that first year, when you think back to that time, who was the player on the team that you got to be closest with that first year?
Well, it was no question, Brett Nelson. And he's one of my best friends to this day. Brett was in my wedding. He's a very, very close friend. He's the head coach of Holy Cross now. Him and Matt Bonner were the two guys that I just gravitated towards that I would hang out with the most. Brett at the time, I believe, was in his junior year. Matt was too as well. And we ended up living together that following year, me and Brett. And then after their senior year, Brett went on to play professionally in Sweden. And then he came back and ended up finishing his degree. And Matt Bonner obviously got drafted and played in the NBA. And that first summer back, Matt lived on our couch. And we kind of like Matt Bonner, like, you're in the NBA. You don't have to sleep on a couch, buddy. We can probably find you a little bit better setup than this. But, you know, it was definitely Matt and Brett, no question about it. I'd be in the gym with those guys rebounding late at night, snapping passes to them, you know, and two guys that love to be in the gym and love to work. And, you know, all of a sudden here I am as a sophomore in college. My senior year in high school, Florida made that run to the Final Four. They lost to Michigan State in the national championship game, and I was right there. Me and my dad went up there to Indianapolis to watch that. So I watched Brett as a freshman, you know, kind of skate around North Carolina, and he had an unbelievable freshman year in an NCAA tournament that year. And here we are 2 years later, and I'm rebounding for him in the practice facility. And, you know, him and Matt, and it was great. It was an unbelievable time.
Yeah, that's very cool to be able to experience it sort of on the fan side of it, and then suddenly there you are, a part of it. And I'm sure that was a thrill. And again, just with all the connections that you and your family had previously to University of Florida, made it even more special. When you think back to your first experiences with Coach Donovan and kind of being a part of the staff, what are some things that you remember that maybe were a little bit surprising to you that you didn't realize that coaches spent so much time on when you first, you know, kind of got behind the curtain, so to speak, and got to see what was going on? What were some things that surprised you?
Well, I think, you know, at that age, in high school, you guys aren't watching nearly as much film. When I was in high school, we barely watched any. And I know that a lot of coaches today are doing much, much more with obviously technology as it continues to advance. But I was blown away. You know, I'd go up in the video room while these guys were breaking down tape and breaking down every single action and every single set that every single team runs. And coach would just sit there and watch film after film after film, and the amount of edits these guys were making on every single thing that the team was doing. At that age, I was, you know, a sophomore in college, I couldn't believe it. I was blown away at just the amount of film and tape that these guys were doing. You know, back then, you know, technology is not nearly.
It was a little different, Matt. Right? It was a little different.
Like, I remember, like, I'm having, you know, my first year on the team, we end up playing Creighton in the NCAA tournament in Chicago, and it's Kyle Korver, and he actually had an unbelievable game. They beat us in the first round of the NCAA tournament. But when we got that matchup, I remember driving to the Jacksonville airport to meet the airplane where the film on Creighton was coming from.
Isn't that crazy when you think about that?
And race it back to camp. That's how you did it back then.
Yeah, it's insane.
Was no synergy. There was no just hopping on the internet. It was all tape to tape, deck to deck video. And you went and got like five or six videotapes of Creighton, had to run from the Jacksonville airport back to campus late at night, give them to these guys. They start cutting them up. I mean, I was blown away at just the amount of video that went into the whole deal, you know, especially back then.
How much time did you get to spend sitting with them, just kind of, again, as you said earlier, as the fly on the wall while they're breaking down tape? Did you get to sit in on a lot of those sessions too?
You know, I didn't get to sit in. When I was a manager, when I was a student manager, I didn't sit in on any film sessions with the team. I would go up in the video room and see if, you know, coaches need anything, if they needed me to run and get them lunch, if I needed to, you know, get them another tape. I would sit there with those guys and watch them break down tape, you know, and scout the games, especially with the video guys or the video staff. And then, you know, I'd constantly be asking assistant coaches if they needed any help. Is there anything I can do? You know, Donnie Jones was there at that time. Anthony Grant was there at that time. John Pelfrey was there. Tom Ostrom was there. You know, so like I got to, it became me just establishing relationships with them through asking if they needed any help with anything. But in terms of being in there with the team while Coach Donovan was going over film study, I was never in there as a student. That kind of came and evolved once I transitioned into grad school and then became the ops guy.
All right. As a manager, what was your favorite memory from the time when you were a manager, both maybe something behind the scenes and then maybe just a game or two that you remember that really stands out for you?
Well, I mean, you know, obviously my second year in grad school, I was a graduate manager, was the first national championship, you know, and being a part of that, seeing that, being on the bench, that's something that obviously I'll never forget. You know, there's a million stories I could tell you from behind the scenes. My first day, I'm on the court and I'm completely intimidated by Coach Donovan. He's got the barrel chest, the slick back hair. You think this guy is like all business all the time. And I'll never forget, it's my first day. I just got hired. We just finished individual instruction. Actually the first practice of the year, and our practice facility was set up that you could kind of sneak up these back steps and it went right to coach's office. And everyone's cleared off the floor. I'm still out there. I'm kind of cleaning up some stuff and putting some basketballs away. And I'm like, all right, you know what? I'm going to shoot around a little bit now. There's nobody in the gym. There's nobody left. And I shot a ball and coach comes through the doors, is walking towards the door to go up to his office. And I didn't realize he was close, and it misses and hits him on the top of the head. And he turns around and gives me a look and said, hey man, next time just say heads up. Never spoken to the guy up to that point in time, nothing. It was my first day on the job, and I hit the head coach, a future Hall of Famer, right in the head off a shot I didn't even need to take.
That's hilarious.
I did not need to take, you know, but that's a memory that'll stick out. And then, you know, when we were making the run in 06, College Game Day was there. We're playing Kentucky in front of College Game Day. They had Rajon Rondo, Randolph Morris. They had a terrific team. And Jay Billis wanted to do a pick and roll segment with Coach Donovan out on the floor. So Coach calls me into his office. He said, hey, Matt, I need you to gather a couple of the guys. I need about four guys with you to help you or to help me with this segment that I'm going to do out there on the floor. I said, great. So I go gather, you know, four of the other managers. We put on, you know, the Florida practice jerseys. We all go in a weight room, do a couple curls, make sure our arms are going to look a little bigger on national TV. And Billy comes over to me and he goes, I'm going to put you in the corner. Okay. And we're going to talk about playing and spread pick and rolls. And when I come off and I throw it to you, I want you to shoot it. Now, keep in mind, this is going to be on national television.
That's a little pressure, Matt.
You got students in the stands. Everybody's there. And this, I said, Coach, no. Let me be the screener or the roller. No. Get in the corner. When I throw it to you, shoot it. And so he puts me in the corner. I'm like, whatever you do, don't shoot an air ball. You got to hit the rim. And here we are. We just did a couple curls, a couple bench presses. And he comes off and he goes, I'm going to throw it to the best shooter in Gainesville right here. And he throws me a pass. And I shot a set shot from the corner just so I didn't shoot an air ball. And it went through the net. And the players were going nuts. Horford and Noah come on the floor, like chest bumping me.
That's
Corey
awesome.
And Green, those guys. So that was a pretty cool memory for a guy that never got to play in college to hit a shot like that on national television. I'll never forget that.
You still have that tape?
Somewhere. I don't know. My wife probably threw it away on one of the seven moves we've had. But somewhere it's got to be in the archive somewhere.
That's good stuff. That is very, very cool. So when you went from being a manager And then you obviously got the GA position, and then you get the director of ops job. So just talk to us a little bit about sort of the job description in each one of those positions, just for people. We get a lot of young coaches that are listening. And I think just to kind of clarify maybe what your role was in each of those different positions within the staff, just so people out there have an idea of what it is that you had to do, what your responsibilities were.
Yeah, you know, I was very, very fortunate. When I was a graduate manager or a GA or whatever you want to call it, getting my master's degree, back then, coaches couldn't work with players in the summertime. So what would happen was, is this is how I really got kind of my start in terms of coaching. I would be the guy in the summertime that was working guys out because it was legal. The managers could be in the gym with the guys, snapping passes and putting them through workouts. Well, that was me. And it just so happened at that time, it was Noah Horford, Corey Brewer, Maurice Spates. Those guys were the guys that were coming through the program. So I'm a GA, I'm a graduate manager, and I'm the guy kind of working these guys out over the summer. And it was unbelievable experience for me at that time. As a manager, you can be much, much more involved in practice. You know, you can't technically practice, but you may be thrown out there on the scout team for a drill or a guy to contest shots as guys are running off screens and, you know, stuff like that. You can do those things as a manager. So from that standpoint, it was unbelievable. There's days in practice I'd leave there, you know, in a sweat, you know. But the workout piece, the summer workouts piece, where you're down there, you're the guy rebounding, you're snapping passes and trying to put them in drills on your own, I got to really, really grow as a coach. When you transition into the ops role or the video role, the freedom you have to be out on the floor with the players is completely taken away. You're really the guy that's up in the office doing all the administrative work. You're not allowed to do anything down on the floor with the players. So when you're looking at being a graduate assistant where you could go somewhere, get your master's degree, you're going to have a lot more freedom to be out on the floor interacting with the players. Whereas you're an ops guy or a video guy, you're not going to have that luxury. So I think that for me, that experience to get my master's degree and go through that and be able to be a part of that and be working guys out and out there on the floor with them, and I think that was unbelievable experience for me.
And I'm sure not only from a coaching standpoint, but just from on a personal level to be able to build the relationships with those players as a coach, I'm sure that that's something that probably served you well over the course of your career, is just gaining more of an understanding of how to build those relationships with the guys who were part of the team.
I mean, it was, you know, I was fortunate to be there at Florida during that time. And I was a piece of, you know, those national championships, a very, very small piece. But like you're saying, the relationship, the relationships that were built being there during that time, being in the gym with Noah and Horford and Green and Humphrey and Richard and Brewer and all these guys, you know, those relationships are lasting through the day. Being up in the office and with Anthony Grant and Donnie Jones and Larry Shiat and all these guys that I was at Florida with during that time, I mean, you'll never forget that. And that was huge for me. I was able to learn just how important that is. At that age, I mean, the day that Anthony Grant, this day, I'll remember forever when Anthony took the VCU job after we won the national championship in 06. It's ironic. He called me and offered me his ops job. And I was going to VCU. I was on board. I was on the plane. I had the bags packed. Here I come, Richmond, Virginia. We had a very, very close relationship at the time with Coach Grant. And 5 minutes later, after he offered me the job, Coach Donovan calls me, and I'm thinking he's calling to congratulate me. And I pick up the phone. I say, Coach, thank you so much for everything you've done for me over these last 6 years, 5 years. I'm so grateful and forever indebted to you. And thank you. I've got an opportunity. He's like, yeah, I heard Anthony offered you a job. I said, yeah, he did, Coach. I'm thanks, man. I really appreciate everything you did for me. What do you mean? I want to offer you the same job here. And I'm like, now I was like spinning. I didn't know what to do. And, but I saw when Anthony left I saw the impact that it had on our players, on Noah and Horford and Brewer and all those guys. And to me, it was a really cool deal because it made me realize just how close, and not that I didn't know it, but just how close he was with those guys and the respect level that he had with our players just from him building relationships on and off the floor with those guys every day. That was great for me to see, you know, at such a young age, just how important as an assistant coach your relationships with players is. I mean, that was a powerful, powerful thing for me to see at a young age.
All right, so talk about that. What's something tangible or specific that you can point to that Anthony did or that you continue to do to build relationships with your players? Obviously, we know spending time and conversations, but is there anything that you can point to that really helped him or helped you or continues to help you in building relationships? What are some things you've had some success with in terms of building relationships with players?
Well, obviously, I think, you know, Coach has done a terrific job and continues to do a terrific job. And the year he had at Dayton was, you know, second to none. I think back then I would see him in practice, you know, really engaged in practice each and every day. I mean, he'd have a pad, you know, and these big guys, these front court players would be doing drills and jump hooks and miking drills and lineups and all this. And Anthony would always be down there and sweating with them and working with them. It wasn't like he was working them out, which he was, but he was working with them. And he would work up a sweat just like all of them. I mean, it was, and there became like this bond that you could see he could build with these guys just being out there on the court. Obviously, I think the amount of time that you spend with your players off the floor is huge. I think, you know, something I try to do as a head coach is meet with our guys once a week. So I'm engaging with them. I'm talking to them about things that maybe have nothing to do with the game of basketball. You know, but watching Anthony work with guys out there on the floor at that point in time, I gained great respect for. And it's something that I try to do. It's something I've tried to do as an assistant. It's something I've tried to do as a head coach is when we're doing individual instruction, you're not just roaming the sidelines. You're out there and engaging and working with your players. And I think that they need to feel that from you, that you're out there. And I think Kevin Eastman talks about it all the time, like get a sweat with your players so they can feel you're invested in them and getting them better. I think that's huge.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that when you spend time with them and when you're out there and you're grinding, just like you said they are, I think that's something that players respect. And if you're engaged with them and you can help them get better, then it's going to be easier to build that relationship if they know that you have their best interest at heart and that you're trying to help them get better and that you can help them get better by being prepared with whatever it is that you're doing. Talk a little bit about your relationship with Coach Donovan just over the course of the time from when you first started and you hit him in the head with a shot.
Yeah, rocky start.
To the end where obviously when you finish there at Florida, I'm assuming that he's eventually helping you to move on to get your next position. So just talk a little bit about how the relationship developed over the course of the time while you were there.
Yeah, I mean, it was built really, I think, just over trust. And, you know, I would try to get to the office before him, whether I was a student manager, a GA, an ops guy, I would always try to beat him there and make sure that he knew I was there and there to assist and help in any way I could, and really, really serve the program. That's what I was always trying to do. Just serve the program. How can I help? How can I be, you know, not add value, because I think a lot of times when you hear the term, I want to make sure I'm adding value. I think that's kind of an ego driven thing. And you're really kind of talking about yourself. I just wanted to serve the program. I just wanted to help. That's all I wanted to do, you know, and it just kind of grew over time. I mean, my senior year in college, I went into his office and was like, Coach, what do you think's next? And he said, I'll tell you what's next. You're going to go to grad school. You're going to stay here and get your master's, and we'll talk about what's next after that. And I said, perfect. Let me enroll in grad school and go get my master's and did that for 2 years. And obviously kind of shared the Anthony Grant VCU story when Coach Donovan, you know, called me and wanted to keep me. And I went from being a graduate assistant, graduate manager, to being the director of basketball operations at the University of Florida. So here I now I'm full time, and I really became, you know, coach's right hand man. You know, wherever he went, I went. I was the first seat on the bench. You know, it was funny that the national championship game in 2007 was on the other day, or a few weeks back, and I met her long after that, and we were watching the game, and I was talking to her about different things. And that game, I'll never forget, Billy turned around and asked me for a paperclip. And I'm like, Coach, it's the middle of the national championship game. Where am I going to find a paperclip? And then like 5 seconds later, he screams at me, I need a paperclip. I'll take off to the back, you know, and try to find a paperclip in the middle of the national championship game. But, you know, I was his guy. I was, you know, I was helping him in any possible way I could. And I did that for 2 years, and I walked into his office and I said, Coach, I'm forever indebted to you for everything that you've done for me, but I want to coach. I want to recruit. I want to be on the floor. I want to teach. I want to scout. I mean, I had the opportunity to learn how to scout from some of the best that ever did it. I mean, when you watch John Pelfrey and Larry Shyatt and Anthony Grant and Rob Lanier and, you know, Donnie Jones go in front of the team and present their scouts, they just had this poise about them. They had this calmness and this energy to get the message across. And I watched that. I learned that. And I felt like I was ready. And I walked into coach's office and said, you know, Coach, I want to be an assistant coach. I'm forever, again, grateful for everything you did. And he's like, you know what, Matt? We got to find you a coaching job. And if you go out there and get that experience, I'll hire you back here. But I want you to go get that experience. And Mike Jarvis got hired at Florida Atlantic. And Larry Shyatt and Coach Donovan hounded Mike Jarvis. I mean, Larry Shyatt must have called the guy 30 times before Coach Jarvis picked up his phone and really got me in the door with Coach. I drove down. I jumped in my Chevy Trailblazer. I drove to Boca Raton. I had a 3-hour meeting with Coach Jarvis, and he hired me, offered me a job on the spot. And, you know, a lot of that was because of Coach Donovan and, you know, the success we were having at Florida, the recruits that were coming in from the state of Florida. It helped me with that. And I'll never forget my 2 years down there. I was grinding, you know, at that point in time. Budgets were a lot different. Wasn't making very much money at all. But it wasn't about that. It was about the experience. And I'd constantly stay in touch with Coach Donovan. And I'll never forget, I had met my wife now. And my second year, I just finished my second year down. My first year down there, we were 6-26. It was the longest year, you know, I've ever had. I mean, you think about it. Yeah. 2 years before, the streamers are coming down. We just won a national championship. We're back-to-back national championships, top of the world. Bang, 6-26. You know, and I'm living down in Boca Raton, Florida. And after my second year, I got offered an ops job at a Power 5 school for a lot of money. You know, I was like, wow, man, the ops guys are making tons of money. Holy cow. And I called Coach and he said, you need to sit down. You need to stop worrying about anything financially right now. You're too young. You need to keep working. You need to keep getting experience and I will hire you back. And the guys, unbelievable, he was a man of his word. You know, next year he loses three assistants. Richard Pitino goes back with his father. Rob Lanier goes to Texas. Larry Shyatt becomes the head coach at Wyoming, and Coach Donovan hired me back. But it was just the build of relationship that me and him forged over the time that I'm forever indebted to him for everything that he's done for me and continues to do for me this day.
All right, give us a quick summary of advice from those stories. I think I could probably do it, but I want to hear you do it. So if you have a young coach who's out there, somebody who's just starting out in the profession, somebody who's currently a manager at the school where they go, where they attend, just give us the 30-second piece of advice for what they should do in terms of their career path and kind of how it applied to what you just went through.
Yeah, I mean, I think the biggest thing is it's all about relationships, your work ethic, your willingness to serve whatever program you're at, not chasing any jobs, definitely not chasing any jobs at a young age. financially. I mean, I get it. And it's, you know, easy to say when you finally put yourself in a position to make a good living in this business, but we all started somewhere. And at that age, at that time, that phone call that I made to him, where it was sit down and get back to work, you know, if I would have left there at that point in time, it really would have been a financial decision. And that would have been bad for me and my career and my trajectory in this business. I would not be the head coach at UMass today had I done that. And you just gotta continue to put your nose to the grind, continue to work. And if you stay humble and you continue to serve whatever program you're at that point in time, great things are going to happen for you. Being a normal, good guy, working hard and investing in the relationships with the people that you have on your staff is huge. Always making sure the program comes first. You know, when a young coach gets a job, it's all about, well, I got to sign a guy. I got to get a guy. I got to get a guy. I got to get a guy in recruiting. No, you don't. You've got to get the right guy. Your program has to get the right guy. And I think that's one of the biggest things, too, that just even as a young coach, when you get on a staff, it's not about your guy. It's about who can the head coach coach and what is best for the program. And you got to remember that bar none, no matter what.
Yeah, I think that's great advice that applies across levels. I think you can apply that to the high school level when you're thinking about assistant coaches. Clearly, you can apply it to the college level. I think ultimately, whenever you're in that assistant role, it's just so important that, you know, I love this story with the paperclip because I could totally relate to that, not from the coaching side of it as much, but I remember when I was playing in college and I remember there were times where my head coach would ask for something or say something that seemed completely nonsensical in the moment, kind of like what you described, like, why does he need a paperclip in the middle of this national championship game? And I just remember several times where he'd say, I need whatever. And all our assistant coaches, I still remember like this deer in headlights look that they would all get. They'd all kind of be looking at each other going, does he really want that? Where are we going to find that? How are we going to answer this question? It's just totally, you know, totally out of the blue. But again, they did whatever it took to be able to support their head coach and try to get what he wanted. Because again, he's the man leading the show and making sure that you're doing what's right for the program. I would think that's a great, great piece of advice. What was it like in terms of, how was it different, your role when you go back to Florida as the assistant? Obviously now you're out of the director of ops position, so you're back on the floor, you're getting to recruit, you're getting to do the things that you described earlier. So just talk about how your experience was different that second time through.
Yeah, I mean, you know, here I spent 3 years at Florida Atlantic. Coach Jarvis gave me a tremendous amount of freedom down there to recruit, to work our players out and scouting and everything. And obviously we were fortunate enough to win a championship while we were down there, and Coach was great to me. And you know, Coach was a man of his word. Coach Donovan, he called me, he hired me back, and it was, you know, it was get back to work. The other two guys he hired were John Pelfrey, who had just been the head coach at the University of Arkansas, and Norm Roberts, who had just been the head coach of St. John's. So I'm now walking back into a situation with two former head coaches that couldn't be better people. And we had an unbelievable staff. I tell people this story. At that point in time on our staff, you had Oliver Winterbone, who went on to work with the Thunder for a number of years. You have Mark Dagnall on staff. He was a special assistant to the head coach who is now on Billy's bench with the Thunder. We had Darren Hertz, who now is an assistant at Dayton. We had just unbelievable people. And last summer, Mark Dagnall got married, and everybody came back. And it was our secretary, Tracy Paff, our trainer, Duke Warner, our strength coach, Preston Green, our academic coordinator, Tom Williams. Coach Donovan was there. Oliver was there. I was there. And it's no secret to why we won. It's because there was just everyone had the program. It was the program first, no matter what. And that's what Billy would preach every day. So when I got back there as an assistant, obviously I was extremely appreciative of the opportunity to be there. And I really tried to dive in from the relationship piece with our players, just because you got two former head coaches, you knew that their voices were going to carry a lot of weight in practice. And that didn't need to be my role. You know, and I think that that's another good thing for coaches to understand. You know, everyone wants to add value. Everybody wants to be heard. Everyone's voices want to be heard. Well, you also got to have a feel for your coaching staff and the experience of your coaching staff and who's there and who's been there. And you still got a lot to learn, you know. And when I got back there, I was fortunate, you know, that Norm and Pell were both there. And here you got two guys that both have been successful head coaches, but really on a staff then that of all the support roles, those guys had been there for a number of years. So it was more just coming through the door and getting to work and recruiting, continuing to establish relationships with the people in the state that I've been able to do over the, you know, last three years at Florida Atlantic, and really try to dive in to the relationship piece with the players that were there. Because it's not easy when you lose three assistant coaches and you got Brad Beal signed. You've got Kenny Boynton, Irving Walker, Eric Murphy, Patrick Young, Will Youget. You got a really, really good team coming back. Scotty Wilbekin. I mean, you got a good team coming back. So you know, I thought diving in there with those guys relationship-wise was the biggest thing for me to do coming through the door, being back at Florida as an assistant.
So once you get those relationships established and you start getting into that recruiting process and you get out there and you're able to coach back on the floor, talk a little bit about what Coach Donovan's recruiting philosophy was. What were some of the things, obviously beyond the talent out on the floor, what were some of the key things that he asked you to look for, that you looked for while you were a part of his staff, in terms of maybe some of those intangibles that you guys were looking for?
Yeah, you know, I think Coach's recruiting philosophy really evolved probably through his 19-year career at Florida. You know, the rules kind of changed and evolved as well. And I think that his, you know, philosophy and he's always been a huge, huge development guy. And he tells the story all the time that that's how he got Mike Miller. You know, Mike Miller was being recruited by every school in the country, you know, and Coach kind of made a promise to Mike that he'd work on him with his game more than any other coach in the country. And he was a man of his word. And that's why Mike came to Florida at a time where Florida wasn't a popular choice. I think for Coach, you know, he would always talk to us, you know, he talked to us a lot about competitiveness, you know, and when you watch them play, is winning important to them when they're out there on the field? They play the game with passion. What's their basketball IQ like? You know, I think that that's two reasons Coach has an enormous amount of success in the NBA. One is because of the type of person he is and the human being. And two, it's just his mind offensively, how it works out there. He loves guys that have great feel out there on the floor. They know the right play to make. He loved front court players that can really, really pass. But Coach was really gravitated towards guys that just played the game with enormous amount of passion. And just that competitiveness and that will to win was very, very important to him. And then, you know, we would sprinkle in a McDonald's All-American here or there, you know, but we hung our hat, or Coach hung his hat a lot on the development piece, you know, Horford, Noah, Bonner. I mean, those guys weren't McDonald's All-Americans, you know, Corey Brewer was, you know, then we had like that group of Patrick Young, Will Youget, Scotty Wilbekin, Casey Prather. Well, Patrick Young was the only McDonald's American. Those other guys. So we put a lot of, you know, into the development piece of our players. And I think that too goes back to relationships, because there weren't a lot of guys that were transferring out of Florida. Now, Scotty didn't play much as a freshman. Casey Prather didn't play much as a freshman or a sophomore. But those guys developed and got better. And Casey was a Wooden Award candidate his senior year, and Scotty was SEC Player of the Year. So, you know, seeing that those guys, you know, evolve and get better through their career was important for me to see.
Yeah, I think the relationships and the development, you put those two things hand in hand, and now you're able to overcome some of those challenges that I'm sure all coaches are facing. And we can talk about that as we get to, once you get to be a head coach, just the challenges of, I think, keeping your entire roster engaged and understanding that on a 15-man roster, not everybody's going to get the amount of minutes, the amount of shots that they want to get. And once we get to your head coaching stints, we can talk a little bit about how you go about handling that, because I think that's a key component to being a successful head coach. So let's kind of transition there and talk about how the opportunity to go and get the head job at UT Chattanooga, how that comes to pass.
Yeah, I mean, I think, listen, anytime you're at the University of Florida, the success that you're having breeds opportunity. And that's exactly what happened. I got an opportunity because of the success that we were having there at Florida. And, you know, we had that year where we won 30 games in a row. We went to the Final Four, and there were some jobs that came open. There was some interest from some athletic directors and some search firms. And Coach Donovan's biggest thing to me was always, don't chase a job. Let these guys come to you. You shouldn't have to go win an interview. If you got to go win an interview, okay, it's not the right job for you. You've got to want to, you know, the relationship that he had with Jeremy Foley that is still so strong to this day. I mean, when you go watch the press conference when Billy took the Thunder job, I mean, Foley was emotional because of their relationship. And Coach always preached that to me. You want to have that relationship, that bond with your athletic director, that foxhole mentality that you guys are in this thing together. So that's really what happened. I had some opportunities. Coach wasn't very high on any of them. And the Chattanooga thing happened, and he was like, that's the one. And, you know, he had been in the league with Chattanooga when he was at Marshall, and he was like, that's the one. That's a good job for you. That's the one you got to get. And he, you know, he's the one that kind of started everything. The athletic director reached out to him first, and it kind of evolved from there. And, you know, drove to Atlanta, had an interview up there, and was offered the job the very next day. It was funny. We had a recruit on campus, and when we were at breakfast with the recruit, I think it was a Saturday morning or Sunday morning, and the athletic director, David Blackburn, was calling on my phone, and I said, Coach, it's David Blackburn. He said, let me take this. And he got up, took my phone, walked out of the restaurant, came back in, and goes, you got the job, but you got to go now. So I was like, can I talk to him? Like, what's up? And that's really how it started for me at Chattanooga. And got on a plane, flew right there, and walked into a room full of players that, you know, obviously I think that they had their world rocked when their coach left. And we had an unbelievable group. We had some seniors or some juniors at the time that were getting ready to be seniors that had been recruited two coaches ago, you know, by John Shulman. And, you know, there was a group in there that wanted to stick together. Not one guy left. Not one guy left. I walked into that room knowing about the team and knowing that they had a chance to be really, really good. And I just walked in there and said, guys, I'm here to help, you know. And it took off from there. We had 100% retention that year. And I think those guys really kind of came together. I knew I didn't have to go in there and crack the whip or dive in and start preaching culture and all this, because I could feel in the room just from my first day there that this group wanted to stay together. They wanted to stick together, and we sprinkled in a piece or here or there, and we took off.
So when you get that and you walk in on that first day and you get that sense from your players, how's it different? What's the feel inside of you as the head coach versus the assistant? Forget about the X's and O's and just the text, you know, the tangible side of it. Just inside of you, what did it feel like to be the head coach versus having come through and been an assistant for the number of years that you had been?
Well, I think you always dream of the opportunity, right? And you know, even as an assistant, and this is why you don't know what you don't know, right? But you dream of the opportunity. You've got it all laid out, right? You got it all laid out. We're going to play this way on offense. We're going to run this. We're going to do this on defense. We're going to press. We're going to trap. We're going to be disruptive. But you've never sat in the seat. And it's just a completely different feeling. And I think the thing that I really tried to do when I got to Chattanooga was go in there with an unbelievable amount of humility. And really kind of take the approach of, hey, I'm here to help. Let's bring this thing together. I know if we can sacrifice for one another, we have a chance to be really good. We got a chance to be special, you know? So the feeling was, obviously this is a dream come true. You're now a head coach, and those first 90 days, I don't care if it's your first head coaching job, your second, or your 30th, your world is spinning out of control. And there is so much going on and so many things coming across your desk and so many phone calls coming in. And this guy's got a player. This guy's got a player. That guy's got a player. Got to hire a staff. Got to do this. Got to do that. Got to boom, boom, boom. And it is, it's overwhelming. It really, really is, you know. And but from the standpoint of the feeling, it's a dream come true. But you really don't know what's getting ready to come your way. And that's something that until you're a head coach, you don't know what you don't know, you know. So it's something that's obviously a very humbling experience.
So what was the first thing? What was priority number one once you kind of got your head straight? What was priority number one? Staff? What was the first thing you had to do?
Well, I think the priority number one is the players. I think staff is very, very important. You know, I knew that group there at Chattanooga. I wanted to keep intact for the most part. I mean, we had Casey Jones coming back, who was preseason player of the year, Justin Toyo, defensive player of the year. I mean, we had a really, really good team. Greg Pryor, Trey McClain, Eric Robertson. I immediately started meeting with those guys one-on-one that first night. I mean, I got through the whole team before my press conference. So I think that's a big thing. You gotta get a feel for those guys, where they're at. You're not gonna establish your relationships with those guys in that short amount of time, but you gotta start diving into your team and diving into your players. I think, you know, staff, probably the next piece, very, very important. I kind of knew a couple guys that I wanted to hire, guys that I'd either worked for in the past or guys that I had been around. I think I had three guys in mind. I had a strength coach in mind already from who I had worked with at Florida. So I think that's another important piece. Who are the important people on campus? The academic advisor you're going to work with every single day. Who, you know, the relationships you can have with people throughout campus, your donors, calling your donors, you know, things like that. I mean, there's just a checklist of things. And the biggest thing is you can't do it all at once. It's just one thing, one step at a time.
I can only imagine. So what was, if you think back to now, you've done it twice, obviously you did it at UMass too, those meetings with the players, what are those conversations like? Do you go into them with some questions that you want to ask each one of those players, or is it kind of more free-flowing? Just talk to me a little bit about what those individual meetings with players look like when you first come in.
Well, on both trips, what I try to do is do as much research as I can on each guy. Where's he from? Is there a connection with someone that I know or something? Maybe it's his AAU team or his high school team or his prep school team. Where's he from? Where did he go to high school? Where did he go to prep school? Is there any relationship that I have somewhere down the line with him in terms of that? And maybe I know his coach. Maybe I, you know, where is he from? I think that's a big thing. I don't think you can go into any of those meetings trying to be very direct with anything. You're not going to get kids to really, really open up at that point in time. But I think it's just really about establishing dialogue. Let them get a feel for who you are as a person. You know, who you're going to be as a coach. You know, one of the things that I did both times was, hey, I'm going to be in the gym on Saturday morning. You know, I've had a press conference on Thursday or Friday. I'm going to be in there on Saturday morning. Anybody wants to come by and get some work in, it's not mandatory, but let you kind of get a feel for how we're going to do things. Let you get a feel for my energy out there on the floor. You know, that's something that I try to do at both spots. But I think in those first meetings with those players, it's very hard to get them to open up about anything. I think you just got to start establishing some level of dialogue and really give them a feel for who you are, what your values are, and how this whole thing's going to go.
That makes a lot of sense. What's the, when you first get that opportunity to be a head coach, what over the course of those first two seasons at Chattanooga, what did you absolutely love about being a head coach compared to being an assistant? What was something that you as the head coach got to do that you just really loved having that responsibility as the head coach?
You know, I always loved practice, whether I was an assistant or whether I was a head coach. But I think I think as a head coach, I enjoyed it even more. As an assistant, you're going to have a say in practice. Hey, coach, I think we should work on this today. Or, hey, coach, I think we should work on that. Or put this drill in or do that. But as a head coach, you're the guy that's actually planning practice and going down on the floor for practice with your plan on how we're going to do things, on what we're going to work on. I love practice as a head coach. I love it. I love being down there on the floor, involved in drills. And not that you're not as an assistant coach, but obviously as a head coach, your voice is carrying the most weight down there. And that's something I love. I got to be honest with you, game days there as an assistant coach, they're a lot less stressful. Okay, show up to the gym, you know, get your day, you get your game day run in, you got this, that, and the other. You don't have to put your suit on too early because you're going to be the guy snapping passes and warm-ups. There's a lot less stress as an assistant coach on game day.
I'm sure.
As a head coach, it's a little more on your mind. No question about it.
Yeah, no doubt about that. I think that when the one loss doesn't go on your own personal record as an assistant, as just thinking back to your own time as an assistant coach, and I spent a lot of time as an assistant at the high school level, there's just a totally different level of investment. No matter what you say, there's a difference between the investment and the head coach who ultimately has that game on their record versus the assistant coaches who don't. And I think you hit that and described it perfectly in that little story right there.
Yeah, and I think, you know, as a head coach, some of those walks to that media room, there's some long walks. There's some long walks to the media room. As an assistant coach, absolutely, you don't have to go to the media room. You know, as a head coach, you got to go to the media room. And sometimes those walks are a lot of fun, and sometimes they're a little longer than you'd like them to be.
All right, let me ask you this, because this is something that I think you've probably been able to see the evolution of. Talk about maybe just the impact of social media from the time you started way back when up until where you are right now. Just how has that changed your life as a coach? Maybe something that's positive, and then maybe some things that maybe aren't quite so positive about it.
Yeah, I mean, it's completely evolved. I mean, it's crazy. I mean, when I was a GA, I think that Facebook was just starting, and there was no Twitter, there was no Instagram, there was nothing. It was just Facebook, and then it was MySpace. And just to see this stuff evolve, and just the amount of information that's out there on your program that I think from a recruiting standpoint, from a marketing standpoint of your program, I think it's all very, very positive. I think there's a lot of things that you're able to do and content that you're able to get out there for fans to see, but also for recruits to see. But you can see, you know, whether we're doing things over the summer of our team, or, you know, our locker room celebrations after the, you know, a big win. You know, I think that fans and recruits and people can really see, you know, our culture building and our team building, where, you know, I think it was harder to do that, you know, 15, 20 years ago. You know, obviously every fan base is going to be passionate. You're going to have your loyal fans that are always going to say very, very positive things about your program. Then after a couple losses, you're going to have fans that are ruthless and don't have anything positive to say, and even have negative things to say. And, you know, I think as a 38-year-old guy, you know, when you're in this business as a coach, you got to have some thick skin, and you got to not pay attention to it and block it out. It's harder if you see people talking negatively about your players on there as 18, 19, 20-year-old kids. I think that's the negative side, because they just have complete access to your players and can say anything, you know, they want. And it's easy for me to go home and just put the phone down and not look at it and turn on the game film and start thinking about how we're getting better. I think it's harder for 18, 19-year-old kids to block that stuff out. And that's the biggest negative thing, is when you can see some fans, you know, really going at guys that, you know, at that age, that, to me, that's one of the hardest things.
Yeah, I would agree with you. I think if I go back and kind of think about my playing career and just think about just the way that it sort of went, and I don't want to say pressure, because it's probably the wrong way to put it, but just the demands that are placed on you as an athlete. And then, you know, you put pressure on yourself, and you have demands from coaches and professors and all this stuff. And then I never had to deal with people coming at me on, you know, on the internet, on Twitter, when you have a bad game. And I think that you're right, that it's one thing to go after somebody who is an adult, who's a coach, who, you know, is, I don't want to say used to the criticism, but you just sort of learn to deal with it. It's part of the business. You understand it. But for a kid who's 18, 19, 20 years old, that's a really, really tough spot, I think, to put those kids in. And it's just, it goes to, I think, social media just in general, when you think about it with kids at all levels, not even kids who are athletes, but just there's no real safe haven anymore. It used to be, before the time of social media, you could go home, and even if you were having a tough day at school or somebody was teasing you or making fun of you or said something to you, you go to your house and it's kind of this safe haven. Nobody can get to you. And now, you know, we all carry around that device in our pocket. People can get to you whenever they want. And a lot of kids at that age, 18, 19, 20, aren't necessarily mature enough to do what you or I might do and just put that phone off to the side and not look at those things.
That at button on Twitter can be very, very ruthless at times. And
no
just,
question.
It's hard to not hit it. You know, it's hard to not hit it. And, you know, I think as much as players market themselves and brand themselves through their own social media and their YouTubes and their announcement videos and their, you know, everybody's got to have a video announcement nowadays, right? Like, there's no more days of just picking up the phone and committing. Like, everyone's got a video announcement, you know, right. And it's
absolutely,
that's the positive side of it. That's fun. Everybody likes to see it. Retweet, retweet, retweet. But you go 1-for-14 and your team loses on the road in the Atlantic 10, don't hit that button.
There's stuff coming. No question about that. All right, before we leave Chattanooga, I got to tell you that the arena there, the Roundhouse, is probably my favorite. That is probably my favorite college arena that I ever played in. We played there, I think, when I was played in a tournament. I think it was when I was a sophomore, I'm pretty sure. But I just, my recollection of it, I was only there the one time that we played, is just that all those seats are just on top of you. I just remember just that arena blew me away. It was just such a fantastic venue to be able to play in.
It was great. You know, we would, obviously, when you're in Chattanooga, what a great town, great people. You're in an area where, especially during football season, you're so close to the University of Tennessee. You're so close to the University of Georgia. You're so close to Alabama. You're close to all these places. So there's so many different sporting events going on at the time. But you start getting into Southern Conference play, man, that lower bowl in the Roundhouse is full. And it was a great environment. We had some great times, some great wins in there over the 2 years that we were there, and established some unbelievable relationships with some great people. And, you know, it was a difficult decision to leave, because, you know, we had a great team coming in. We had Jalen Crutcher coming in, who's now, you know, at Dayton, had an unbelievable year. Rodney Chapman, who starts at Dayton, had just finished his freshman year. We were in a good place, and it was a very, very difficult decision for us to pack our bags up and leave.
So talk about the decision. What made you decide to take the leap?
You know, it was I was in a place where, you know, again, we had had two good years, one really, really good year, and battled some injuries my second year there. So I had had some, there was a couple schools that were calling, and had had some conversations with some other schools, but was really committed to staying there. And I'll never forget, I was watching Florida play in the Elite Eight on a Sunday. They were playing South Carolina, and Coach Donovan calls me that day, and he said, "Hey, I got a phone call from UMass. What do you think?" I said, "Coach, all I know about UMass really is Marcus Camby and John Calipari. I don't know enough about it to say that that's a job that I would really, really want to go after or take." And he said, "Well, they're calling me, and I think you got to take the job." And I was like, wow. I kissed my wife, my two kids. I jumped on an airplane. I went to Florida to recruit. I had meetings set up on Monday morning in Florida with a couple different players and home visits and stuff like that. And sure enough, at 7 a.m. the next morning, I wake up and the search firm's calling me saying they wanted to meet with me in Boston that afternoon. I said, well, I can't do that. I got two home visits set up here. If I cancel these visits, it's going to put me in a bad spot with these players. So the search firm calls me back and said, can you meet tomorrow morning at 8? And I said, sure. So I called Coach Donovan back and I said, they want to meet. He said, great. You got to take the job. I was like, all right, Coach. Well, let's see how this meeting goes. We'll make a decision from there. And I ended up flying from Orlando to Atlanta. I had my assistant at the time came to the Atlanta airport, brought me a suit that my wife had packed. Awful shirt tie combination. I can't believe she packed me that. I ran through security, grabbed the suit, went back through security, jumped on an airplane, flew to Boston, landed in Boston at 1 o'clock in the morning, and met with the athletic director, Ryan Bamford, the next morning at 9. And walked out of the meeting after meeting with Ryan in Boston for about 3-4 hours, and my phone rings, and it's Billy. And I said, hello? He said, Matt. I said, yeah. He goes, how's it go? I said, I think it went pretty good, Coach. And he goes, they're going to offer you the job. What do you think? And I'm like, Coach, honestly, I think the athletic director is a great guy. I don't know. Got to take the job. Got to take it. I said, all right, here we go. Let's go to UMass.
Did Billy just want you in the Northeast or what?
Well, my wife wanted me in the Northeast. My wife's from New York.
Okay.
She's from Long Island, New York, and her being close to her family was very, very important to her. But I think Coach felt Ryan Bamford's energy. I think he knew the tradition and the history of the program. I think he knew that UMass is really, really starving and that Ryan was going to give us the resources necessary to compete in the Atlantic 10. And he just felt like it was the right step for me at that time in my career. And that's what happened. We left the hotel there in Boston. We drove out to Amherst, and give Ryan a lot of credit, man. He didn't take any of the back roads from Boston to get to Amherst. He took the highway the whole way and walked me through the facility. I mean, we have a brand new practice facility, and I was just blown away at the infrastructure off the rip. And went back up to Ryan's office, and he offered me the job that night. And then obviously saying goodbye and leaving a place is very, very difficult. And that's one of the hardest things you've ever had to do as a coach. So that wasn't easy. But, you know, the opportunity to be in the Atlantic 10, for my wife to be close to her parents, and, you know, Coach Donovan putting his stamp on it the way he did, I couldn't pass it up.
All right, so you take the job. What's your first step before you even like, all right, so you got the job. What do you immediately start doing beyond? We talked about with the UT Chattanooga job, talked about meeting with the players, talked about thinking about your staff. That first 24 hours after you accept the position, what do you immediately start to do?
Well, here I am. I'm a guy from the South. I'm from a small town in Florida. I've recruited a lot of my time in the South, whether I was at Florida or Florida Atlantic or Chattanooga. I had some relationships up here in the Northeast, just from some guys that played at Florida, where there was Eric Murphy, Alex Murphy, you know, both those guys were New England guys. You know, Irving Walker was a New York guy. You know, Mike Rosario was a New Jersey guy. Joe Kim played in high school in New York. So, you know, had some relationships through some of those guys. So I just tried to start calling as many AAU guys that I had in my phone that I knew were in my phone that were from this area. And I just started to kind of go through and make a list. And then I started to look at UMass's roster and call AAU and high school coaches of guys that were on our roster. Started to do that. Started to really, really reach out to our biggest donors, the guys that, you know, do a tremendous amount for our school financially. Started to call all those guys. But it was really, for me, trying to dig my heels into the recruiting piece of being up in the Northeast, which was completely different to what I was used to, you know, being in the South.
Yeah, absolutely. Trying to rebuild your whole network that you had kind of spent pretty much the entire, you know, the entirety of your career building. And now that relationship, not that obviously you can't still recruit the South, but you still have to start to build those relationships with AAU and high school coaches up in that new area. And I could see where that would be a huge priority right as you come in the door and start trying to figure things out. As you look at your program, where it stands today compared to where it stands when you first got the job, what were some things that you tried to instill from a culture standpoint, a pillar standpoint, the standards? What are some of the things that you, as you took the job, wanted your program to be known for? And then just talk a little bit about where you are in the process of getting the program to where you want it to be.
You know, Mike, it's I've had to learn a lot. I've had to really, really grow. I've had to get stretched as a leader. I've had to make some very, very difficult decisions, but I've had to learn a lot. You know, when you're at a place like the University of Florida, you are just constantly adding to the culture, and you're around people every day that no matter what their role is, they're adding to that culture. That's what Coach Donovan created, you know, through his 19 years there. That's why when you see him get honored or they name the court after him, just the amount of people that showed up for that to support him, because everyone is just adding into that culture. And I think when I was there, as much as I was adding to it, I don't think I was studying it the way that I needed to. I was studying our basketball piece. I was developing and investing in relationships, which is extremely important. But I wasn't really studying what he was doing each and every day culturally. I would sit in the back of the film room when he'd be up there doing, and I'd just be writing down notes. Whatever would come out of his mouth, I would write down and write down and write down and write down. But really dissecting and studying, what's the message? What are we preaching? What are his values? What are my values? You know, I listened to a podcast with Steve Kerr, and he was, you know, talking about just how he, when he got to the Warriors, him and instilling his values, he met with Pete Carroll, and Pete Carroll talked about, you know, when he got fired from the New England Patriots, he was ready to be the head coach of the University of Southern California because of the experiences, because of the things that he did bad or didn't know or didn't do when he took over some of these other jobs. And for me, I had to go through two very, very difficult, challenging years to open to my eyes a lot. What are we doing culturally? What are my values? What do I stand for? When I got to Chattanooga, we had a team that was built to win. We had really, really good players coming back. We had guys that had been through a lot. We had guys that were in the program. I was their third head coach. And I went in there with a level of humility and just really tried to connect that team and keep that team together. And was I pumping my values to a certain extent? Yes. But I had to learn and really get stretched as a leader and really dissect, what are we doing culturally every single day here at UMass? And I think one of the things that may have set me back or our program back a little bit is my first year, we were able to win some games that people didn't think we would have any shot at winning. We beat Providence. We beat Georgia. We beat Dayton twice that year. And nobody thought we would win over, you know, five games based on how our roster was and some of the turnover and stuff like that. And I almost think that piece of it set us back. But I look at it, Mike, as a good thing, because it opened my eyes going through a very difficult second year here of, man, I got to get a lot better, and I got to grow a lot as a leader, and I got to look and dissect every single aspect of our program right now, and why aren't we moving the needle culturally? Why aren't we doing that? And, you know, I think one of the biggest pieces for me was just the character piece, and not that we had bad people or bad kids, but, you know, I don't want to have to chase guys to class every day. You know, like, what are some of my values? Like, I'm a passionate guy. I want a team full of guys that are also passionate out there on the floor. And these are just some things, Mike, that I've had to learn over these difficult years to now get our program in a place where I feel like we're now finally in a place to take off. I mean, our best player is Trey Mitchell. He was second in the league in scoring this year, only to Obi Toppin, but Trey's got extremely high character. He's a 3-5 student. He's in every class. He's got tremendous work ethic. He's the kind of kid that you want to coach every single day. And for me, you know, I think those are the kinds of guys that I do really extremely well with. And I think I had to learn that over these last couple of years and find out what was really, really important to me. And as difficult as the times and experiences I had to go through, I had to do it. I had to learn and grow as a leader.
So is that a combination of understanding the type of player and kid that you want to recruit and bring onto campus, along with some of the things that you're doing day to day, then to continue to build upon the qualities that those players that you're bringing in already have? Is that kind of how you'd characterize what you're trying to do?
No question. I took a step back after my second year here. And again, I've got a great partnership with my boss, Ryan Bamford, and he knew we needed to make some changes and do some things differently. And he supported me 100%. And I looked at, you know, the rosters since I've been a head coach for 4 years, and guys that I felt like I did a great job with, and guys that I felt like maybe I struggled with. And, you know, what are the characteristics of these guys? And what are the characteristics of these guys that maybe I've struggled with? And, you know, I tried to dissect every aspect from that standpoint, from a recruiting standpoint. And it was a pretty eye-opening experience for me. And I think it's really, really helped me as we've moved forward.
Yeah, I can see where once you start to go through, and I think your story, just all the way going back to the very beginning, about just continuing to be able to learn and to be humble enough to understand that I don't know everything, and I've got to reach out to the number of people that you have in your network who have had a tremendous amount of success. I'm sure those people have been tremendously valuable to you. And yet, all that being said, no matter how much you talk to your network, no matter how much you reach out to your mentors, no matter how much you're studying the game, it still comes down to, as you said, you got to get that experience because you don't know what you don't know. And I think what you've just described perfectly sort of encapsulates that whole idea that you have to continue to grow as a coach. And I think that goes all the way back to, you had to probably grow when you were a manager, and now you're having to grow as a second time head coach so that you can be at your best for your players and your program to be able to give them the type of success that you hope to have. We're coming up close here, Matt, to about an hour and a half. So I want to give you a chance to just answer one or two more things. And the first thing I wanted to ask you is, when you think about being the head coach at UMass and you wake up in the morning, what's the one thing that gets you super pumped up, super excited, that you can't wait to get out the door and get to work? What is it that you just love about being the head coach there at UMass?
I think that, you know, first and foremost, the players on our team right now, just I've got an excitement to get in the gym and get to work. We've got guys that want to work that are gym rats. I think that's the first piece of it. You know, looking at it, and this is the other thing that I had to do, like, you know, there has just been pockets of success here over the last 25 years. You know, what Cal was able to do in the 90s over that five-year run was remarkable. It really hasn't been done since then. And there's a fan base up here, which we alluded to earlier, that is very, very passionate, that loves their school. And it drives me to get up every single day. And it excites me that, hey, we got a chance here to change the trajectory of this program. I think they haven't won an NCAA tournament game since 1997 or 90. I mean, it's been crazy. So we've got a chance to really put our mark and our stamp on this program where it hasn't been done. And they can talk about our players, or the players that are here, that will change that for the rest of their lives. And that excites me for our players, that they have an opportunity to do that, and I need to help them in any way I can to help them do that, to help them change the trajectory of UMass basketball and do something here that hasn't been done in a very, very long time.
I love the humility of that answer, and I think it speaks to just sort of your whole entire story, that you talked almost every step of the way about being there to serve the program. And that answer that you just shared is basically, you're here to serve your players and then ultimately serve the UMass basketball program. And I think that speaks to the old saying that it's fun to be part of something that's bigger than yourself. And that's kind of what I take away from your answer there, as being a challenge. 100%. So that answer just totally resonated with me and made a ton of sense. All right, I have two more questions for you. One, okay, kind of a not silly question, but one question that's a little silly and then one that's serious. So I'm going to ask the serious question, then I'll end with the silly one. So the serious question is, when you look forward now from where you are right at this moment, what's the biggest challenge in front of you to get UMass basketball to where you want it to go?
Ooh, you know, I think that we've got a roster here that's extremely talented. We've got, you know, we're going to have a really good senior class with two seniors, one that's been with me from day one since I walked through the door here, and Carl Pierre, and then Mark Gasparini, who's a grad transfer. You know, we're hoping that Noah Fernandez gets a waiver to be able to play right away from Wichita State. So we feel like we have got a roster full of high character kids that's ready to win. But we're also very deep. So I think the biggest challenge for me and our coaching staff this year is getting guys to completely buy into their roles and understanding that maybe my role last year on this team is going to look a little different than this year on our team, and still being able to have a positive attitude, give great effort every single day. I think that's going to be our biggest challenge. And I think that's the biggest challenge, you know, for us, this program going forward, especially, you know, right here, you know, in the short term. And I just think that obviously, you know, we're all dealing in a very difficult time here in terms of when are we going to be able to get back? When are we going to be on the floor? What does it look like from our budget standpoint, things like that are out of our control. But I think that, you know, for me right now as the leader, it's going to be really getting, you know, a roster full of guys, a very, very talented, very deep roster, by far the deepest roster we've had since I've been here, to buy into their roles and make sure that we keep, you know, the team first and have a positive attitude and give great effort every single day.
That's the better problem to have than the opposite one, where you don't have enough talent. It's better to have more talent and try to figure it out. Not that it's not a challenge, because I know it is, to be able to get guys to buy into their role. All right, here's my silly question. It's not really silly, but have you had a chance, or have you tried to reach out to Dr. J at all? Have you had a conversation with Dr. J?
I have. I've talked to him a couple times on the phone right when I got here. I had the opportunity to go down to the Hall of Fame, and it was amazing to me. One of the years that I've gone every year that they've done the enshrinement, because it's only about, you know, 20, 25 minutes away. But when the first time I met him, I went down there with some of our guys from development, Jason Germain, who's a former walk-on at UMass. I went down there, and we were standing there waiting on Dr. J to get from the entrance to where we were standing, which was probably – it wasn't that far. I'm going to say it was 100 feet. And it took him, I want to say, an hour to go 100 feet because of the amount of people. Like, you forget how, like, I mean, we all remember how good of a player he was, but just the star, like, just the celebrity status of him.
Absolutely.
Especially in that environment at the Hall of Fame, it took him an hour to go 100 feet. So he was great. He was very, very gracious to me and got to spend, you know, 10, 15 minutes. But really, you know, all these guys, Marcus Camby's been great to me. You know, Coach Cal was one of the first people I reached out to when I got the job. He's been great to me. The people that are still here around this program in this community just hold him to the highest regard, and because of what he did and the run that they went on here in the 90s. And you know, a lot of former players. We have Tyrone Weeks' son on our team, who had a great freshman year and then ended up getting hurt and was going to get the year back. But, you know, the alumni, the former players, the fans, the donors, the loyal UMass fans have been great to me and my family. And we're just excited to keep it going in the right direction.
Absolutely. That is fantastic. Matt, we can't thank you enough for spending this time with us. Before we get out tonight, I want to give you a chance to let people know where they can find out more about UMass basketball, how they can reach out and connect with you and your program. And then if there's any final point you want to make before we wrap it up, I'll jump back in and wrap up the episode.
No, I mean, obviously we're very, very alive and involved in social media and UMass basketball. I think it's at UMass basketball. My Twitter's at Coach Matt McCall. You know, the more fans we can get as we continue to move forward, we're excited. We're excited about our team. We've got a great coaching staff that's done a terrific job in recruiting. And, you know, we're just excited to move this thing forward. So it's been a pleasure to be on with you, Mike, especially, you know, during these times. We're all at home. We're hopefully everyone's out there staying safe and continuing to do our part in this pandemic. But it's great to talk ball. It's great to be on a podcast and escape some of the craziness and the bad news that's out there right now. But I just appreciate you guys having me on. And if I can help you guys anyway in the future, man, please don't hesitate to reach out.
Awesome. We really appreciate it. Matt, we can't thank you enough for spending that time with us tonight. And to everyone out there, we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Coaches, we've teamed up with Coach Tyler Whitcomb so you can now purchase his exclusive new playbooks right from the Hoopheads Pod website. If you're looking for ways to improve your team next season, these playbooks blend affordability with the quality content that serious coaches are looking for. Just visit hoopheadspod.com/store and you'll find playbooks from John Calipari of Kentucky, Leonard Hamilton from Florida State, and Mike Young of Virginia Tech. Check out these great resources at hoopheadspod.com/store.
Hey everyone, last year at the Junior NBA Summit, I came across an amazing company called iSport 360 and its founder, Ian Goldberg. Their youth sports app gets coaches, players, and parents on the same page. Your team can set goals, share player feedback, training videos, sticker rewards, player evals, and practice assignments. All of this to foster a healthy team communication and culture. If your team or club struggles to keep open lines of communication, especially among team parents, iSport 360 can help. If you want to empower your athletes to have more success, more confidence, and more communication with their teammates, give iSport 360 a try today. Shoot me an email, mike@hoopheadspod.com, or give me a call at 216-392-4059 to learn more.
Being without basketball right now is tough for all of us. So we've partnered with Pro Skills Basketball to offer you a 50% discount on their ultimate shooting guide and video program that will put players on a guided path to becoming the best shooter they can be. With 1 year's worth of workouts that includes games, drills, and competitions, players will gain access to a blueprint showing them what it takes to become an elite level shooter. If you're looking to improve your shooting at home, this program can help. Visit hoopheadspod.com/store to check it out.
Thanks for listening to the Hoopheads Podcast, presented by Head Start Basketball.